You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support the show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Tuesday, August 1st, 2017. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the four-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, best-selling author Naomi Klein on No Is Not Enough. Also on the program today, Scaramucci gets a cut loosey.
And Sarah Huckabee still in the building.
And there's a new sheriff in town, folks. But the town council is still insane. And the townspeople, also crazy. And the sheriff himself was vicious as the head of Department of Homeland Security when it came to immigrants. Meanwhile, that same guy, Kelly, now chief of staff, apparently called Comey to express anger that Comey was fired. We'll see how that sits in the way. Begin the slow
looks
burn.
Like someone might not be chief of staff anymore.
And speaking of the Donalds, turns out the Donald dictated the Junior's lying statement about his Russia meeting. That's odd. Jesus. And will today be the day that Donald Trump announces his attempt to topple the health exchanges? And will a lawsuit by insurance companies stop him? Meanwhile, Democrats make a tax reform offer Republicans can really only refuse. The NAACP issues a travel advisory to Missouri. And a hacking conference shows just how vulnerable our voting machines are. Meanwhile, Kristen Gillibrand reverses on that BDS law. 2020, here she comes. And the Seth Rich conspiracy, apparently, according to a lawsuit funded by a right-wing financial advisor who had also informed Sean Spicer, which is also interesting, if true. All this and more on today's program. You know, the part about that, and we'll get into that maybe later in the fun half. I mean, I don't want to spend too much time on it, but There has been obviously ongoing debate. You always hear that meme, like, don't get distracted. Don't get distracted. And, you know, it's become a joke about what you're getting to. Don't get distracted by the crushing of healthcare because it's covering up the crushing of healthcare. But
don't mind me. I'm turning the whole country into a...
But this Seth Rich thing, you'll recall that the Seth Rich story was based upon the supposed quotes of a supposed private eye who was also a Fox contributor. Apparently, this Fox contributor is suing, claiming that his quotes were made up, that he was a patsy all along in some respects, and that there was maybe not coordination, but that Sean Spicer knew about this and that it was time to come out at a specific time of controversy that the White House was going through. And the point being on this that, and we'll get to this a little bit later, but the point being,
and we'll remind everybody of who this guy was who's suing. It's not like he's has a credible track record.
Well,
that
that's
this
true.
Undermined.
That's true. Right. And it's also, you know, you can only take what he's saying with his lawsuit with so much grain of salt too. But my point is that if it is the case that that's true, and I don't know, you know, we'll talk more about it later, but specifically the idea that the White House wanted that Seth Rich story to come out when it did, then it shows at least some awareness. I mean, these people aren't complete. Well, I don't know. It's hard to say they're not complete bumbling fools, but they're not completely unaware of media dynamics, right? The point being is that how much of the stories that, you know, that they, how much is manufactured and how much is put out there just for distracting? I don't know. I'm still skeptical because that would involve a lot more. I mean, these guys would have to be super, super diabolical, I think, in some of these instances. They certainly would be if they were smart enough. I just think that's a big if. All right, but it is true that the Scaramouche is gone. We will get to that in a moment. You'll notice that I am well shaven today. Well, I shaved last night, but so I'm fairly well shaven, but I certainly was comfortably shaven. And you know why? For decades, there's been one big razor company who has relentlessly increased prices and reaped immense profits at the expense of its customers. So two guys, Jeff and Andy, they got fed up with getting ripped off, and they started Harry's to fix shaving. Sort of like why I launched the Majority Report. I just got so pissed off at
people getting ripped off by the mainstream razor companies that have been ripping people off for far too long.
So Harry's knew there was only one way to ensure quality. They bought their own blade factory. And the best part, as far as I'm concerned, and you will be too, just $2 a blade compared to the $4 or more you pay at a drugstore. You would think for $4 you'd get to keep the thing for like 6 years.
Oh, no.
Shaving, for God's sakes.
You spend like $15 and it's done in like a couple of weeks.
All right, so you know the things I like about Harry's. It is significantly less expensive.
Hello.
It's delivered to my door. And it's like, it's a nice shaving handle. It's not, the ones that look like they're all geared up that, it's like Rambo. It's like a Buffy type of, paramilitary thing with the, you know what I'm talking about? Like the grips and I like a little bit more of a classic looking thing. And Harry's is so confident you're going to love their blades. They're giving you their trial set for free. You just cover shipping. Your free trial set includes a weighted ergonomic razor handle. That's what I was talking about. A 5-precision engineered blade with a lubricating strip and a trimmer blade, which is good for me because of my nose. Yes. Hello. Rich lathering shave gel and a travel blade cover. That's a $13 value for you to try. Stop messing around. Get started with shaving with Harry's today by claiming your free trial. It's a $13 value for free. You just cover shipping to get your free trial set, including razor handle, 5-blade cartridge, and shave gel. Go to harrys.com/majority report right now. That's harrys.com/majority report. Let's do this Scaramouche thing. Apparently, Greg Gutfield. And I don't know if he's actually making two jokes. Here's Greg Gutfield signing off on the Scaramouche. Oh, did you? You didn't even get the Borish thing.
Oh, I downloaded it.
I just have to note, I just happened to check the YouTube chat, and James Will put hello inside the parentheses. I thought that was a great tag.
That's a good
on that.
One. So Scaramouche is gone. Apparently, when Kelly comes in as chief of staff, first thing he does is says goodbye to Scaramouche. Just remember, okay, while you're out there, making fun of this guy, the guy sold his company. Although it's also held up, I think, by regulators because it appears that he got overpaid. Maybe, I don't know, because of his proximity to Donald Trump.
Why would that happen?
That may go away. He sold his company. And apparently, I mean, his wife dumped him on Monday, I guess, the day after he decided, I'm not going to make it to the birth of our first child, but I will text you to make you know that I'm thinking about you and to claim that he's praying. Well, apparently while I was at the Boy Scouts.
I'm praying for a fucking kid.
Yeah, of course. So Scaramouche leaves to take more time with his family. Well, I guess not so much. But here is how they're responding on Fox.
Brace yourself, Ed. Greg has a question. Could be a statement. We're not sure.
I have a hypothetical question. Do you know who...
I don't answer a hypothetical.
Well, I'll answer it then. Do you know who lasted longer than Scaramouche at the White House? Anyone who's ever taken the tour. I don't want to hammer him too hard. Flynn, he may end up working
Rice
here.
Right.
I don't want to make it awkward in the men's room.
Yeah, there you go.
That's the funniest thing that Greg Gutfeld ever said in his life,
yes,
and the most
true.
Insightful one.
There's an answer to this that also includes, you know, there's precedence for being out of this. So John O. Kohler, who was chief communicator for President Ronald Reagan, who was a great communicator, in March 1987, had an either shorter tenure of less than 1 week. Kohler arrived at the White House.
He arrived at the White House.
Yes. I thought it was closer up in the article. Basically, he turned out to be a Nazi youth.
Oh yeah, and
hey, what happened?
And now and during the Reagan administration, to quit the Nazi youth, people were very very upset about that.
So that shows a lack of commitment.
Yes,
or maybe it'd be more like, you know, we can't have Nazis around. Now I'm going to go fly to Germany and go honor their grave. Didn't he do that? Didn't he go to some Nazi graves? Or is that unfair?
It was the, I don't know how.
Totally wrong to do
that.
What
are you going
to
do?
Now I've got to go to Philadelphia, Mississippi and talk about states' rights.
Exactly.
And when,
well, he did that before he was president. But, yeah. So Scaramouche is gone and... we'll find out who the next Scaramouche is probably within a couple of days. And the real question is, will John Kelly do what? I don't know what he is supposed to do other than maybe just get down to business and, you know, really make it difficult for immigrants and others in this country. I mean, I'm not terribly excited for this to be a more disciplined White House. I don't know that it's going to make a difference, but if it does, I'm not going to be happy about it.
Is
it?
I don't think it's possible.
Now, I will tell you what I am happy about, not having to go out of my house to shop for clothes. I don't know if people are aware of this. I'm not a big clothes horse. I'm not one of those people who have a ton of... Wait, is it clothes horse like where you got a ton of clothes?
Honestly, never heard that phrase before. Clothes
maybe I'm making
horse?
That up. I don't know.
I thought that was that. Like for maybe a model, like you just wear the clothes and show the clothes off, but I could be wrong.
I don't know. But I don't know if there are people out there who hate shopping for clothes as much as I do. I mean, it's extremely deep-seated and ingrained in me. Well, now I've found an easier way to get better clothes. Bombfell. It's an online personal styling service that helps men find the right clothes for them. And in my case, it's almost like a de-styling. Unlike other services, no fees to work with them, so it costs nothing to sign up. It's simple and straightforward. All you have to do is complete a questionnaire, and a dedicated personal stylist will handpick your pieces specifically for you. And then once you've viewed your selections, you'll have 48 hours to make changes or even cancel altogether. You're in total control. You only pay for the clothes you keep. Plus, you have the options of receiving clothes once every 1, 2, or 3 months. Because Bombfell is on your side, they don't make money if you don't find something you want to keep. All right, so here's what I put them through, okay? I have such requirements, and my tastes in clothes are so bland. Like, they have really nice clothes. And so... I fill out my form. They assign a, basically a stylist, I guess. They pick out clothes for you. And I'm like, nope, I don't do logos. Nope, I don't do, no. That's too hip looking.
No.
Nope, that's no. not plain enough.
Young.
So they sent me the stuff.
Nice.
I got pants, two shirts. I liked one of the shirts, but I was like, I don't like the other ones. Too fashion forward for me.
Fashion forward?
Well, whatever. I don't know. And one had a logo. One had a logo, and I don't like to wear logos.
I'm with you on that. I think wearing logos.
You're wearing an Adidas shirt right now.
It's Naomi Klein.
That's great.
Well, but I don't like to wear logos. I don't wear
Naomi Klein.
Okay, so I don't like to wear logos because when I was a kid, my Levi's patch on the back said Husky because I was fatter. And so you would get Husky pants. And I'm like, I don't want to. It's like going around with pants and say fat guy. Yeah, they don't do that anymore because they realize, like, I guess people don't want to be considered Husky. But so I don't like any labels. We went through the process like two or three times, and I am getting up shirts and pants that I like. And guess what? I didn't have to go to the store. Best of all, we've negotiated with Bombfell for our listeners for an offer of $25 off your first purchase when you go to bombfell.com/majority. You got to check it out. There's no obligation. You sign up. If you don't like the clothes, it's definitely worth a try. Bombfell, bombfell.com/majority. All right, we're going to take a quick break. I spoke to Naomi Klein, I guess it was on Thursday of last week or Friday. I can't remember. Always a pleasure to talk to Naomi. We were interviewing her back in like a 2004, I think it was, on the Majority Report. She was one of the first people I wanted to talk to because No Labels, which was, I think was her first big book.
No logo?
No logo.
No logo.
Rather.
Not no logos.
was influenced by the Situationists. And that was back in my days of my Situationist fetish. So, quick break when we come back. Naomi Klein. We are back, Sam Seder, on the Majority Report on the phone. It is a pleasure to welcome back to this program the best-selling author of No Logo, Shock Doctrine, This Changes Everything, Naomi Klein. Also, now I think at The Intercept as well.
Yes.
Naomi, thank you for coming on. And author of, I should say, No Is Not Enough, which is a book that you published... you wrote relatively quickly, particularly quickly, relative to the works you've done in the past. Just let's just discuss that.
Sure. Yeah, I'm actually a pretty slow writer when it comes to books. It usually takes me about 5 years, and I somehow managed to write this, including the editing, in 5 months because I was in something of a frenzy wanting it to come out. And also, for my previous books, I generally had a pretty steep learning curve going into an area that was new to me for each of the books that you listed. So it's kind of like getting a PhD in a new subject for each one. But for this book, I was able to draw on, 20 years of research and just focus on the writing.
Yeah, I mean, that was we were saying before we started, it so much of what you had written about in No Logo, I imagine, when we first interviewed you back in 2004, Janine and I on Air America, we probably talked about at that time as well, came flooding back to me as I'm reading this because you're drawing on that, and of course this is also a bit of a how-to guide in terms of preparedness. And you're talking about these issues that I think particularly plagued me in the months following Trump's election, things have gotten a little bit more. I've been a little bit more distracted from those essential questions, but they've returned. But let's start with that your discussion of how Trump won by becoming this ultimate brand. It builds on the work that you did in No Logo, talking about the transformation of brands from sort of representing what they made to sort of an emotional, to an emotion that can be applied in different areas.
Exactly. So, I mean, marketing has always been about emotion and selling, to some extent, ideas. It comes out of the dawn of the Industrial Revolution, where, you know, people used to buy their core products from people they knew and trusted. You know, whether it was whether it was scooped out of a barrel in a local grocery, or whether they bought their food from a local farmer, they had relationships of trust, right? So when mass production was introduced, suddenly people are buying products without those relationships of trust. They're coming from factories far away. And so that's when you saw the first brands like Uncle Ben's and Aunt Jemima, and they're designed to replicate those human relationships, right? So it's these comforting sort of down-home figures, right, that are being substituted for actual relationships. And yet, these companies behind these brands are first and foremost manufacturers. They are manufacturing these products that they are then branding and then buying advertisements to tell customers about them. What I was writing about in No Logo almost 20 years ago now was this shift that happened in the 1990s when that kind of marketing was no longer working. Consumers were no longer willing to pay the kinds of premiums that that they used to just for a brand name product. And so so companies needed to dig deeper. So this is when we started to see the rise of what came to be called the super brands, which was a term first applied to Michael Jordan. These are companies like Nike and Starbucks that announced that they are not about the products. They are not manufacturers. They're first and foremost about the creation of ideas, the manufacture of ideas and lifestyles, which they can extend into a huge number of products and build these kind of self-enclosed cocoons. The ultimate, I guess, expression of this when I was writing No Logo was Disney built its own branded town. Remember Celebration mm-hmm. Florida, yes. Right? Which is this fully branded town, and in many ways the ultimate expression of how you can build a self-enclosed lifestyle around a brand. And Donald Trump used to be a guy who built buildings, but after The Apprentice, he embraced this model of the hollow branded company that really doesn't care who manufactures their product, because they see their act as of their act of creation being the creation of an idea. So Trump started to do that with all of his spin-off products, his water, his ties, his suits, and all of that. But then increasingly just started leasing the Trump name to developers around the world. He's not building those buildings, as we know. He's just selling his name. And I think that all of this is important in terms of understanding the relationship that he has with his base, and also the depth of the conflict of interest between his presidency and his business holdings. Because just by being president, I mean, yes, there are active conflicts of interest that are taking place, but the mere fact of being president is massively inflating his brand and allowing his sons to be out there selling the Trump name for a great deal more, because they are now selling the brand of the president of the United States.
And theoretically, I imagine, too, you know, some measure of access, particularly when you have an administration that seems to be so, I guess, unprofessionalized or so unsystemic, right? That the idea that Eric Jr. can call up Dad and say, "Hey, do X, Y, or Z," and it gets done because they're going to operate that way. But so, what is?
No, and I mean, I think one of the things that's really corrosive about all of this, right, is that what they are selling is less, you know, memberships and golf clubs, although there's some of that, right? Because Trump does still own a few flagship properties. And, you know, we know that membership fees have gone up at Mar-a-Lago and so on. And we know that Ivanka's company claims that their sales are up. But the part that worries me more in terms of the opportunities for corruption is just that when the Trump sons are out there selling developers the name Trump, right? It is a product that is completely ephemeral, right? So who's to say what the true market value of the name Trump is to somebody putting up a condo tower or, you know, a hotel? It could be $10 million, it could be $15 million, and if they do pay $15 million instead of $10 million, you know, and the truth is the Trumps have collected much more. We don't know exactly how much because of the lack of transparency, but we know that, you know, one development in Panama apparently has gotten them somewhere around $50 million just in leasing. So if a developer throws in an extra $5 million to buy the Trump name, it's very hard to know why they did, right? Like, mm-hmm. I mean, the Trump sons can just say, well, that's the market value. That's what it's worth. But this developer may have other things that they want from the U.S. government, and paying an inflated price may be deemed worth their while. So there's just endless opportunities for greasing in there.
And, I mean, it seems to me it also, though, undercuts the entire way. I mean, I think there's always been this sort of a measure of corruption, but things become so quid pro quo-ish, right? That, I mean, I just keep thinking about this guy, Bukis, from who's the CEO of Time Warner, I think it is. And in December, he was asked a question at some tech thing on stage. Are you afraid of Donald Trump, because he owns CNN? Are you afraid of Donald Trump in terms of free speech? Because he's been attacking reporters at CNN. And his response was, no, I'm not worried about Donald Trump. I'm really worried about the Democrats with their whole Citizens United thing. That seems to me very dangerous. And, of course, this guy is saying that because he has a massive merger, you know, in front of the Justice Department, in front of the FCC, the FTC, all of them. And there's this sense of, like, we're just doing business on, like, you know, a handshake here quality type of situation. Mm-hmm. And that, to me, you know, we're seeing the destruction of those sort of, like, even tenuous norms that we have in this country.
Well, it's interesting. And I mean, it's also the way in which foreign governments watching Trump and understanding how transactional he is, right? And this is, he boasts about this all the time, right? I mean, this is what he means by how he's going to get a better deal out of every situation, right? And so even if they're not asking for things, foreign governments infer what the Trumps would like, right? So three labor monitors in China who were looking into Ivanka's factories suddenly are arrested, and the organization that they work for says this has never happened before. This is not just like routine labor harassment in China. This they believe that they were targeted because they were investigating a factory that produced goods for the president's daughters. Now, that is a service, one could argue, that the Chinese government is providing to the president's family, getting rid of the people who are blowing the whistle about the absurdly low wages, abusively low wages that workers are being paid to make Ivanka's stuff. Now, they can turn around and go, oh, we abhor this. You know, we don't want this.
Right.
But they are looking at this family and how they work and going, this will be appreciated. But it's interesting, in Canada right now, there's a debate going on, believe it or not, over the fact that Justin Trudeau is on the cover of Rolling Stone right now, and the tagline is, you know, why can't he be our president? And the conservatives are attacking Justin Trudeau for having done that interview because they believe that this will damage Canada's NAFTA negotiations because
right.
it will hurt Trump's ego. I mean, how crazy, but this is how the world understands Trump, and they're not wrong.
And they're not wrong. That's the crazy part. And so, all right. So getting back to Trump's brand, like, what was Trump's brand? I mean, you know, obviously it's,
right.
it's gold lame, but it's more than that.
Yeah. Right. So I mean, this is what's different than what I was writing about in No Logo, was the first stage of these lifestyle aspirational brands that were selling an idea as opposed to a particular product, a lifestyle, was most of them were tapping into kind of progressive values, really. Like Starbucks would say, you know, our idea is the idea of the third place, not home, not work. It's community. It's the coffee house culture. You had Nike saying that they were about the idea of transcendence through sports. And then, you know, Disney, family values, all of that. I think what really sets Trump apart is not the business model, because he embraced this similar business model. You know, you could compare him with Richard Branson very well, who also runs a, you know, very strangely structured, very opaque business set of licensing deals. But with Trump, the difference is that he built a brand around this completely amoral idea of essentially impunity through wealth. His brand is being the boss who can get away with whatever he wants because he's so rich. So it is just the dream of being the winner in an economy that is rapidly stratifying, and it's the world of winners and losers. So that's why the signifiers of his wealth are so incredibly important to building his brand, and that's why The Apprentice is the gift that keeps on giving, because it was just, he was paid rather than paying for the marketing. And it was the endless loving shots of these signifiers of vast wealth, right? The private jets, the helicopters, all the gold. It's why he makes sure there's, you know, gold curtains close to him whenever possible and so on. But it's not, you know, his brand is not just wealth. It's the impunity, the absolute power that comes with that wealth. That dream is what he's always sold.
Everything was geared in that show to putting him on a pedestal. I mean, just even the way they would stage it, where the 8 or 10 people would walk in sort of subservient to him, and he would have two people to his left and to his right, you know, sometimes Ivanka, I guess, mm-hmm. if I remember correctly, and all to make him look like he's sitting on a throne, more or less. And my theory was, too, during the Republican primary, was that this was going to be very effective, because part of the conservative and Republican ideology has been that there is a moral righteousness to you that your money manifests. Mm-hmm. And if you're poor, there's something wrong. It's a sign of a moral reprobate. And if you're rich, it's a sign of just the opposite. And so there was nothing.
And wisdom.
And so there was nothing anybody on that stage when he's debating them could say that wasn't literally trumped by the fact that he was richer than them, or at least appeared to be. And good.
But the only thing I would add to that, Sam, is that I don't think this is just about Republicans. You know, it is true that it's sort of the worship of wealth for its own sake, right? And this sort of the wealth creators, the job creators frame that the Republican Party had embraced pre-Trump, Trump was able to cash in on, right? And it made it very hard for them to challenge him. But at the same time, you know, I think part of the way in which the road was paved for Trump was by liberal figures like, you know, Bill Gates, mm-hmm. Bloomberg, and the whole sort of structure of the Clinton Global Initiative, which was this sort of kind of speed dating between issues needing money and billionaires needing reputational cleansing, brokered by Bill and Hillary once she was out of the State Department, and what this did is it reinforced this narrative that problems that we used to tackle collectively through democracy, like failing school systems, pandemics, were now just going to be solved by benevolent billionaires, right? And that, you know, if you think about the amount of power that a figure like Bill Gates has over the U.S. education system right now, or over African agriculture, it is enormous. And you know, even though that politically he may be very far from Trump, I think that, you know, a decade of reinforcing that narrative,
right,
that because somebody is rich and because somebody is smart in one area, you know, good at software, you know, good at building buildings, that you can therefore transfer that to, you know, to expertise in any area. And so I don't think we can just pin this on Republicans. I think this has been part of very much a liberal idea as well.
And I mean, the idea of inviting Michael Bloomberg to the Democratic National Convention, I mean, there's really no other logic to it other than he's a billionaire. And I guess, you know, Mark Cuban was you know, so closely associated too. Like, we're going to bring our billionaire, as if that is the terrain to fight upon. All right, so.
And one of the reasons I wanted to bring it out in the book, right, is because I do, you know, there's certainly signals that Mark Zuckerberg is sending that he's interested,
yes,
in being the liberal billionaire savior in the electoral sphere. And, you know, there are folks out there who are saying, well, we need to run Oprah against Trump, you know, our billionaire brand against their billionaire brand. And, you know, I don't think that that, you know, I don't think that's the way to go.
Yes. Well, we agree on that. So let's, all right, so let's move into the I want to get to climate. I had a call on the program today, and we're pre-recording this, but I had a call on the program today and saying, you know, we got to remember to keep climate in the forefront. Mm-hmm. And it seems that we are, I mean, it seems in many respects that we are significantly further from, particularly in this country now, from the levers which could impact it. Because we have a climate change denier in office who is really sort of isolating this country from the rest of the world in that regard. And I mean, I guess the question is, and maybe this is earlier than I wanted to get to this, is you know, how we can impact that. Maybe let's put a pin in that for one moment and just go to this other question that I think really dogged me following the election. When we had figures like Bernie Sanders and even Chuck Schumer to some extent saying, you know, we'll work with the president on infrastructure and whatnot. And there was a question of, do you fight the authoritarian impulses of a Trump administration? And I feel like this week we see that, you know, it really comes into relief with the speech to the Boy Scouts, with the speech in Youngstown about immigrants, you know, cutting up women, you know, beautiful 15-year-old girls, and, you know, the question of him perhaps firing Mueller. Do you fight those authoritarian impulses or do you spend your time trying to fight for issues like, let's say, you know, Steve Bannon, apparently it's reported today, wants to regulate Google and Facebook like utilities. Now, I think that's a great idea. But is there a danger that if I was to support those policies, and by I meant we, support those policies, that in some way we're empowering Trump, and in the event that there's another 9/11 attack, all those authoritarian impulses, the work that we've done to promote certain sets of policies actually increase his ability to engage in very harsh authoritarian moves and destruction.
I mean, I sometimes think that when we hear that from Bernie Sanders, that he's willing to work with him, that it's more rhetorical,
right,
than it is something that would actually happen. Because the way Trump will invest in infrastructure is so different,
absolutely,
than anything that progressives can stand behind, right? That it will break down really quickly. Like, I mean, look, I think NAFTA should be renegotiated too.
Right.
But the way I would renegotiate NAFTA and the way Trump is going to try to renegotiate NAFTA are completely different. He is going to make it worse. His Commerce Secretary has openly talked about using the so-called best practices from the Trans-Pacific Partnership, mm-hmm, and getting them into NAFTA. They want to make it harder for governments to appeal rulings and easier for corporations to do so, right? So it's upside down of how we would do it. On infrastructure, you know, it's clear that their first major infrastructure announcement was about privatizing
Right. Air
traffic control. They're already making noises about repealing Davis-Bacon so that the work that is created in infrastructure doesn't pay the prevailing wage or living wage, right? I think it's dangerous to do anything to prop up Trump's positioning as a savior of the working class. I really do. And I think that's a huge mistake. And I think we saw that huge mistake on his first day, you know, in the White House, his first Monday at the White House, when several leaders of trade unions in the building trades, lavished praise on him. I think that was a shameful, shameful moment in trade union history. It breaks the most basic principle of solidarity. I mean, when immigrant workers across the country are being targeted in fear, for their lives because of what Trump is doing, to praise this guy to the skies is deeply ugly and plays into some really ugly history of unions throwing workers of color under the bus, a history that should never be repeated.
And, you know, I mean, I think to a large extent, That concern that I had in those, sort of as he was president-elect, were quickly dispelled as it became clear to people across the board that in fact, when he talks infrastructure, it's going to be, I mean, because there was this notion supposedly out there that Trump was not necessarily consistent with the worst of Republican policies. And he clearly, I mean, to the extent that he has any policies, I mean, he clearly hasn't operated that way. And you see Bannon start to announce this stuff. Like, I mean, he's clear. Bannon is making an effort at the very least to sort of, change that and bring back some of that populism. You know, in the past 2 days, the same three people apparently have told Grimm that Bannon wants to raise the top marginal tax rate to 44%.
It's always difficult. It's really hard to know what to take seriously here, right, Sam? Like, I mean, it's projecting chaos.
Right.
But the timing of this is obviously really interesting, because with Trump attacking Sessions, this is infuriating the Breitbart base. So Bannon sort of there's various attempts to throw some kind of red meat to that base, right?
Yep.
The attacks on, you know, trans people in the military, other attacks on the LGBT community, and I think these signals, I would be very surprised if much came out of them from Bannon is part of that, because I think they're scared. I think the Sessions thing is could potentially be a real blow.
Yeah, I mean, I agree, and I guess so. The tough part is just, you know, when you see. There was Deborah, you know, I don't want to get into like the minutia of tweets, but Deborah Messing, mm-hmm. you know, wrote disgusting the idea. I made the point that I have a whole set of different sitcom people that are my political leaders, but nevertheless, you know,
I didn't get that. I saw that tweet and I didn't realize.
Oh yes, that was a bit of a subtweet, but it's very hard to sort of, you know, separate that. I mean, really, what I would have preferred Deborah Messing's tweet to be like, yeah, I'll believe it when I see it, type of situation.
Exactly.
And all right, so the
but I mean, that also does point to the fact, and you know, and this is something else that, you know, motivated me to rush out this book, which is trying to put Trump in economic context, right? In that this guy could never have risen to power except in the context of a 40-year campaign that has waged war on the very idea of the public sphere and held up wealth as the ultimate arbiter of good. And he is the logical conclusion of all of that, of mm-hmm. Ronald Reagan saying the 9 most dangerous words in the English language are, I'm from the government and I'm here to help. He's all of that, right? And I think if we don't see him in that economic context, then we create a very false and shallow sense of unity within this thing called the resistance, where we tell ourselves, you know, we're all in this same fight, you know, with folks who think it's disgusting to raise taxes on the rich.
Right.
And that's part of the problem.
Yes, without a doubt. I mean, that was my one of my greatest concerns about Trump is that the nascent energy on the left. And it's, yeah. You know, we've been, you know, I think I first interviewed you in 2004. And I think maybe it was about the take, the documentary you and your husband did about Argentinian workers. And thinking about how alien that was, particularly at that time in 2004, of an idea in yeah. the United States in 2004. And now, you know, the needle has moved considerably, you know, particularly for people our age of in this country. It's never been this far left in the United States.
No.
And
no.
My, you know, the concern that I think coming out of the Bush years that I understood was like, wow, I was arguing alongside with people who have no problem cutting Social Security. And I'm surprised by that. And, you know, those people who I thought were my allies and so there's this sort of dual battle going on, right? Because you also do make the point that if there is a terrorist attack, we need to be ready to deal with that. And I guess, you know, the thing is like, I guess, you know, in the event that there is some type of shock, and this is where really the shock doctrine comes in into your, to this book, that, you know, we still got to be, David Frum is on our side for that day, I guess. Right? I mean,
I don't know.
I mean, how do
I don't know if David Frum's going to stay on our side after that day.
Well, that's true. That's a good point of all people. But the,
maybe a better example.
Deborah Messing. I mean, I guess, you know, who is for what it's worth. But the point being like, all right, let's talk about that. I mean, preparing ourselves for that potential of a crisis, whether it's you know, one he creates by saying we're going to invade this country or who knows what, right? Russia shuts down our grid or supposedly does or whatever it is.
Yeah, I mean, this is, I think what worries me most is that so many of the policies that this administration is pursuing make shocks more likely, right? Mm-hmm. And, you know, whether they're deregulating the banks or the, you know, entire industrial sector, and a lot of this they're able to do without Congress, right? I mean, while everyone is saying they're not getting anything done, they're sure as hell getting a hell of a lot done at the EPA, which they don't need to go to Congress for. And it's getting almost no attention in the sort of daily barrage of I mean, there's just so much news, right? So it becomes a one-day story that the EPA is being dismantled to a greater extent in the agency's history, which makes industrial accidents more likely. You know, we'll see whether they manage to completely get rid of Dodd-Frank. We know they want to, right? That makes financial shocks more likely. And the Muslim ban itself makes terrorist attacks more likely because it reinforces the this narrative, this incredibly dangerous narrative that the U.S. is at war with the Muslim world. So there's a lot that they're doing that are making that are making shocks, you know, without having to have a conspiracy, you know, to plan it. No, just what they're doing in order to enrich themselves, and you know, their belligerence makes shocks more likely. And you know, I think there's other things that they could frame as a shock, including civil unrest. But I was really keenly aware watching the response to the Muslim travel ban, which was you know, exactly what we need to be seeing in terms of just the instant response and the fact that people were showing up for you know, for others who, you know, who maybe who weren't directly affected. You know, I think it was real solidarity, not leaving this only to the Muslim community to respond to, but and so we saw that with people flooding to the airports. But I was very aware that is precisely the type of protest that if there was a terrorist attack in the United States or some kind of other civil unrest, then I think Trump would be very likely to say, well, this is a threat to national security. You can't block a road. You certainly can't block an airport. And you know, I don't know about you, but I was pretty aware that we didn't see the repression in that moment, right?
Yep.
And I think that would change pretty quickly if there was a shock to exploit. So I wanted to try to focus people's attention on that and also share some examples of societies which have weathered attempts to use crisis to roll back constitutional protections, to impose some kind of state of emergency, and have come into the streets in huge numbers and defied those attempts. Because if it is just left to the people who are being targeted, if it is left to immigrant communities, if they're targeting, if they're targeting Black communities, then it becomes a lot easier to use extreme force. If there are millions of people in the streets representing all walks of life, it is harder to use extreme repression. Not to say they won't use some of it, but it is harder.
Yeah, I mean, I think the Trump administration was completely caught off guard to the speed in which people reacted to the to that ban. I mean, the people were at the airport so quickly, particularly out in New York. I mean, it was pretty shocking. But that is in some respects is that not enough? I mean, we have. I know that I think like Move On and Indivisible, I think have set up like sort of rapid response type of things you can sign up for in the event that, let's say, Mueller is fired I imagine would be used in other situations. I mean, we don't have a Secretary of State at the moment. He's on break, apparently. And that seems to me to also open up the opportunity for some problems. But what more do we need to do?
Which, in and of itself, I must say, like the fact that you feel better when the former CEO of Exxon is on the job, just shows how much they've lowered the bar there.
I mean, but that's the problem, right? I mean, because on some level, if it's not him, then it's maybe Jared Kushner. I mean, it's possible that it's wholly irrelevant.
There are no good choices.
There are no good choices here. And that's the thing is that each time, people have this dilemma with, I hope Sessions doesn't get fired. I mean, I personally think he is horrific and I would like him to be fired, immediately, regardless of what happens after that. But I can understand the argument of people saying like, but if Mueller gets fired, then, if Sessions get fired, I mean, this is the dilemma you have with this.
Sessions get fired and then Mueller gets fired.
Yeah, there's always this tension. On some level, right? I mean, you don't. It seems to me important to have mechanisms to have a State Department, and I don't know that.
So, I mean, to a certain extent, right? I mean, there aren't good options, and there aren't going to be good options within this 4-year period, which is why the resistance has to be focused. As well, I mean, certainly you have to respond to these daily attacks, there's no doubt, but there has to be a strategy for winning power and for, for things getting a lot better once they're out of power. So, I mean, this in those moments of shock, right, what I wrote about in the shock doctrine is that if there isn't a counter strategy, if there isn't a plan for how to resist, what happens is that each one of these shocks become moments when we don't only lose our civil liberties, they become moments for mass looting of the public sphere. And I began the shock doctrine with Hurricane Katrina as a sort of ultimate example of this huge traumatic event that was systematically exploited under Bush, but with a lot of help, actually, as it happens, from Mike Pence, who was head of the Republican Study Group, who was part of this effort to come up with this wish list of what to do in New Orleans and actually all along the Gulf Coast in the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina, privatizing the school system, creating a tax-free free enterprise zone, building more oil refineries. I mean, just the most bald opportunism, right? But the flip side of that is that these kinds of shocks that we're talking about, whether it is a market shock because they've deregulated the banks or a major climate-related weather shock or a terrorist attack that reveals how dangerous Trump's foreign policy is, if there is a bold progressive movement in that moment that has the guts to step in and diagnose the shock as a symptom of a failed set of policies, a failed system, and propose real solutions as a counter to that kind of opportunism, there can be huge political gains made. I was in the UK a couple of weeks ago and met with Jeremy Corbyn and his team, and it was really striking talking to them about the fact that during their election campaign there were a series of horrific terrorist attacks in Manchester and London, and Jeremy Corbyn actually had the guts to break the cardinal rule and not just condemn the acts of terror, though he did do that, but link it with the war on terror, link it with the war in Iraq, link it with funding for to Saudi Arabia. And rather than hurt him, it seemed to help him because it resonated with the public. And then put forward a set of policies, the Labour Manifesto, which was bold and resonated with the public, and he did much better in that election than anyone expected. This is why no is not enough.
And the healthcare is perhaps one of those opportunities. I mean,
we're seeing that clearly. Yeah.
And so give me your sense of the strategy of winning power. I mean, what is your assessment of Bernie and sort of the resistance as it is at this point?
Well, it's interesting, just in the past few days, we've seen this people's platform strategy emerge. And that's something that, I think we need to see more of this. I think it needs to be even more articulated than what we've seen. This is a sort of a very short set list of more transformative policies, including single payer, getting to 100% renewables very rapidly, a list of bills that have been tabled and sort of strung together as a people's platform that was delivered to the DNC. I'm glad to see the gloves coming off a little bit. I think Keith Ellison's voice in the past couple of weeks has been terrific. This is something else that is really clear looking at the UK parallel, is that you've got to have the fight within the party. There isn't a substitute for really going there. And so electorally there has to be a voice for that, of a bottom up process. There's going to be a battle within the Democratic Party, depending on how it turns out. I think people may leave the Democratic Party. I mean, if this battle is not successful to move the Democratic Party significantly to the left, I think there will be an exodus. But it's clear that people aren't ready to do that yet. They want to fight. And personally, I think it's worth fighting, considering how close Bernie got and how shocking that was. As you said earlier, Sam, I mean, who would have thought a few years back that Bernie Sanders could have gotten 13 million votes and carried more than 20 states? He did do that. So he did do that in a campaign that I don't think thought it had a chance of winning when it first launched. Right?
Say, so yes, he did not think it did. I mean, I think that's beyond question. And I think part of the reason why I think, I mean, what is your assessment as to why he didn't get further even? Let's put it, characterize it that way. I mean, I think part of it is he got in so late because he thought he was just running a messaging campaign. But there were other issues, too, I think he had.
Certainly, I think it's really important for people who did support Bernie and do support Bernie to get out of the Bernie would have won tape loop and look really hard at why he didn't win. And part of it is that, as you say, he wasn't running a campaign to win at the start. But frankly, I think a big part of it was a perennial problem on the white left. Of not centering racial and gender justice from the beginning, right? So it's kind of like, we need to do outreach, after it's already all figured out, right? And there was some important course correcting during Bernie's campaign, but I think that lesson that it can't be course correction. It has to be embedded if you want to build that broad progressive tent, which I believe is a majority, You have to get the temples right from the beginning. And you know, one of the people who I interviewed for the book is Michelle Alexander, who wrote The New Jim Crow, and I think she's got the best quote in the book, which basically says, you know, if the left can't get it together on race, they better have Elon Musk on speed dial, because we're going to need another planet. And this is not just, you know, this is not about pointing fingers at Bernie. This really is a perennial problem on the left. It's a problem at the nation. It's a problem, you know, it's a problem at so many left institutions. It's a problem at many trade unions. And we can't afford to continue to make the same mistakes over and over and over again. We now know that a progressive majority is within reach. It is winnable. So if it is winnable, we have to win.
And we should make the point that it's not just a question of rhetoric. I mean, it is
policy.
You know, it's policy, and it's you know, sort of the team building. I mean, I don't know how to articulate that. You know, he did not have the relationship. And part of the problem with him coming in late was that he could not go and compete with the relationships that just the actual relationships that the Clintons had. Frankly, when it comes to particularly the African American community in the South, and those the tenor of those relationships would be different, wouldn't necessarily be with the same people in these communities. But when Bernie Sanders goes in and makes those relationships, the relationships and what is supposed to come out of those relationships, hopefully, theoretically, is going to look different than it might with. With some without that sort of a set of policies, but you need to bring people, and particularly, I mean, obviously, it's Michelle Alexander's right. I mean, you cannot have a resurgent left or without a major amount of intersectionality. I mean, just in terms of actually
Bernie
people.
Would have won if he had been able to carry 50% of the black vote in key states.
Right.
So it can't just be blamed on the DNC any more than the DNC can blame the Russians, right?
Right.
For their electoral loss. There are a lot of women in my generation and older who have told me, and you know, these are not Hillary fanatics. These are people who wanted to support Bernie, but somehow felt that gender issues were tacked on, that there was a fundamental sort of not getting it about how precarious these rights are. It's about those relationships, and I think it's about really having a deeper story about how all of our issues are interconnected, not just a kind of a laundry list, but really a different frame about these deep connections. Because the right does have that. It's ugly, but they do have it. And unfortunately, I think on the left, we often respond with just a kind of a laundry list, a sort of checklist, as opposed to a different history, a different narrative of how we got here and where we want to go.
And to cap that off, I mean, at the end of your book, you talk about the Leap Manifesto out of Canada. What is that?
So that was an attempt, This is something I think we are starting to see examples of in the U.S. as well, but more at the city and state level. But what this was a people's platform that was drafted by 60 movement leaders. I was part of the process, we launched it in the middle of an electoral campaign. But ideally, you would do it well ahead of an election and really shape the kind of platforms that get out there in the first place. It was endorsed by hundreds of organizations, signed by tens of thousands of people, and it is a plan. The catalyst for it was the climate crisis. It's a plan to listen to what scientists are telling us about how rapidly we need to get off fossil fuels, and listen to what the engineers are telling us about how it is possible to get to 100% renewable energy in the next two decades for electricity and for our entire economy well before mid-century. But the argument that we make in the Leap is that if we are changing the fundamentals of our industrial society, how we get our energy, how we move ourselves around, this is a once-in-a-century opportunity to close inequality gaps at every level. and to begin to heal the wounds that date back to the founding of our country. So it begins with indigenous rights and a full implementation of the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous People, which says you can't have industrial projects of any kind on indigenous land without free, prior, and informed consent. But it really paints a picture of what the country can be. And it was a really amazing process to be a part of, because, you know, when you build a broad coalition like that, when you bring together people in the room who don't usually get in the room together, like environmentalists and, you know, trade unionists representing energy workers and indigenous leadership and immigrants' right leaders, you can't fall back on nostalgia. I think on the white left, there's been an unfortunate tradition to just idealize the post-war period or the New Deal. It's sort of like, well, we just want to go back to that. And when you organize with communities that were systematically left out of those right. leaps forward, they really don't let you fall back on nostalgia, because they were never included in the first place. So it meant that we had to draw our inspiration from the picture of the world that we've never lived in. I think whatever happens on the electoral level in the US, there's nothing stopping these rising social movements that were rising well before Trump from getting together, and this is happening in lots of ways, to map out a people's vision of the world that we want post Trump, and to force whoever wants to take up the progressive mantle in the next election, whether it's Bernie, it's not just going to be, there are going to be many people vying for it, right. To really make them, I think, live up to the vision that is coming from below.
And do you see any, the People's Platform, I guess we came out just a couple of days ago, and sort of almost simultaneously, the Democrats offered their better deal, which was, a marginally better deal. Although there's a lot of people, and I'm one of them, who was pretty encouraged by the antitrust stuff, because it just suggests to me, at least, that they're at the very least searching around, right? Like they're listening to some extent. Was that your take on that as well?
They're inching in the right direction, and I think it's exciting that they're under pressure, and I think we should pause to just acknowledge that it's pretty amazing that people are managing to fight on so many fronts at once, right? I mean, it's really hard to be fighting these attacks from this crazed Trump administration, And at the same time, to be able to put pressure on the Democrats, I mean, that's an organizational feat that is happening in this country. And they're hearing it. They're hearing it on single payer. I mean, whether we've fully absorbed it yet, clearly not. But they're certainly feeling the heat, and that's significant.
That is the one thing in this fight that I think I've been very sort of surprised about, particularly coming out of, getting more engaged during the Bush years, was that you didn't have a Democrat or two in the Senate who ended up, I mean, they were off the table for the Republicans from day one in terms of this repeal and replace stuff. And that was not something that, I was a little surprised by that. And I guess maybe my expectations had been managed by the years during the Bush administration, where the Democrats capitulated as quickly as they could. And granted, it's a different dynamic, but that is somewhat encouraging to see them at least on their heels a little bit.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Naomi Klein, the book is No Is Not Enough. Thank you so much for coming on and talking to us about it today. I really appreciate it.
Great to talk with you, Sam. Thank you. Keep up the great work.
Thanks. Okay, folks, going to head into the fun half. We're a little bit late. I mean, I guess we're not particularly late for anything. Folks, just a reminder, you can support this program, and we need your support. By becoming a member today, go to jointhemajorityreport.com. Pennies a day, ladies and gentlemen, to support 5 days a week of long-form interviews, mildly entertaining repartee, often precise analysis, long pauses, dead air, all that and more exist only because of your support. You can go to jointhemajorityreport.com. And as a way of saying thank you, we give you even more content. We do some funny stuff when we come back. Oh, Corey Lewandowski, he just got fired again today, but apparently for showing up on rival networks. Trump's attorney, Jay Sekulow, he's going to address the report that Donald Trump, well, he didn't address the report. Well, we're doing actually a couple of flashback things, right? And again, like this, I mean, I'm not surprised that they're willing to lie, but the idea that they're lying this much is a little bit on stuff that is going to come out. I mean, somebody.
One of these days they'll realize that they're being recorded and all this is being saved and easily accessible.
We got the Paul Ryan apparently doesn't do anything other than cut ads for himself. All this and more, folks, on the fun half of the program. And, of course, your phone calls and your IMs. So become a member today. JoinTheMajorityReport.com. JoinTheMajorityReport.com. Also, JustCoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. It's fair trade coffee. It's great stuff. And you get a 10% discount when you use the coupon code MAJORITY. It's free shipping. And if you buy your crap from Amazon or you buy your crap from Jet.com, do so through our link at MajorityReportKickback.com. All right, going to take a quick break. When we come back, fun. Oh, wait, do we have that new fun half song? Come on, you got to play that. So we now have two fun half songs. This one is a little bit trippy. You got to listen to this one, Michael. This one's super trippy. Matt is just trying to get his 6-foot bong out of the closet so that he can fire this one up. All right, here it is. All right. Here is the fun half ditty. Listener. Oh, do we know what the name of our listener was who did this? Dan. Deva Luna? Okay, here it is. Sounds like the music you put behind your Nixon tapes. I hope that doesn't freak people out. Oh, you like the other one?
No, I like both of them, but the other one, there was
the other one's catchy.
The one with the with
this one's not so catchy.
This one's more abstract.
This is a little more
abstract. I might not be at the sort of cognitive level to appreciate that one. The other one with the way they drop it, like fun half, and you're just like that's just that amazing. One's good.
All right, we're gonna play. We'll probably play. We'll lean on that one a little bit too. All right, quick break. We'll be right back.
She said, no, 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 no. Things are looking bad. She said, no, no, no.